It is Monday, August 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, Afghanistan's government says it will not accept the Taliban ceasefire unless it's official. Pope Francis writes a letter condemning the clerical sexual abuse and cover-up, and we'll learn why Vietnamese Cajun food is a blend of two cultures. It's all ahead. Afghanistan's government says it will not accept the Taliban ceasefire unless it's officially announced. On Sunday, President Ashraf Ghani announced a ceasefire of up to 3 months with the Taliban, conditional on the insurgency reciprocating. Meanwhile, most of the bus passengers kidnapped by the Taliban in northern Afghanistan have been released following mediation by Afghan tribal elders. Minister of Interior Advisor Bahar Mir said insurgents are still holding 12 passengers from three buses seized early Monday in Kunduz province. VOA's Aisha Tanzim in Islamabad, Pakistan, speaks with me, beginning with the unofficial Taliban ceasefire.
What we've heard from Taliban sources is that the Taliban leadership is considering, or actually they've already told their local commanders not to fight over 4 days of Eid al-Adha, which is going to be this week, Afghanistan celebrating Eid tomorrow. However, the presidential spokesman today, Mr. Chakhan Suri, also said that the government will not consider an unannounced ceasefire a real ceasefire. So they will continue their operations against the Taliban as long as the Taliban leadership does not make an official announcement that they're ceasing hostilities. The government also said that even though they've given a time frame of 3 months, the ceasefire will only hold for as long as the Taliban also announced that it's going to ceasefire.
Apparently, most of the bus passengers who have been kidnapped by the Taliban in northern Afghanistan have been released. How did this release take place? I believe there were some negotiations involving Afghan officials.
Yes, I think the release happened because the tribal elders, the local tribal elders from northern Afghanistan intervened and they mediated between Afghan officials and the Taliban to get most of the passengers released. Now, until last report, 12 passengers were still with the Taliban. We don't know whether those 12 passengers are members of security forces or why the Taliban are holding them. We do know from Afghan officials that some of those passengers were taken to a nearby village. But we do know that the release came about with the help of local elders.
Is it known why the Taliban seized these people?
We don't know exactly why the Taliban seized these people, but it is not uncommon for the Taliban to stop local buses or transport. And usually they're looking for people who are working for the government, especially for people who are working for the security agencies. They usually are very good negotiating tools. So, for example, even now we know that the Taliban are exchanging lists with the government of prisoners that both sides have of each other that they're going to exchange. So if the Taliban has more government prisoners, people who work for the government or security personnel, then they have something to negotiate with. And this could be one of those things.
Now, apparently the Taliban said that it was releasing some of these prisoners because of the upcoming Muslim holy festival of Eid al-Adha.
Yes. Well, what the Taliban mean is not these particular prisoners from the bus. They're releasing prisoners that they already have in their own prisons. And the Afghan government has also asked Taliban for a list of prisoners they would like released. Now, both sides will consider whether the people they're releasing should be, according to their standards, released. So, for example, the Afghan government has said that they will release Taliban prisoners that are either very old or very sick or who have completed their jail terms or prisoners that the Afghan courts have declared were free to go. The Taliban, on the other hand, have said that they've got a committee or a commission that's going to look over the prisoners that they have and decide which one goes free and which one doesn't. The Afghan government insists that the release of prisoners should be according to lists that the two sides exchange because They've said, or the presidential spokesman Harun Chahansuri said, that we don't know whether the Taliban are releasing our guys or just ordinary people that they've randomly kidnapped in various parts of Afghanistan. So the prisoners that Taliban have announced that they will release are separate from the bus passengers, most of whom have already been released today.
VOA correspondent Aisha Tanzim in Islamabad, Pakistan. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. A jury is deliberating Paul Manafort's fraud charges for a third day. President Donald Trump calls Robert Mueller's Russia probe a national disgrace. The Malaysia's prime minister calls for China's understanding in his country's fiscal woes. And at least 10 people are killed in an earthquake Sunday on Indonesia's Lombok Island. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists have measured the chemical compositions of 18 planetary systems that are as far as 456 light years away from us. The scientists compared the compositions of the exoplanets to that of our planet and determined that many of the elements found on the distant planets are not only present on Earth, but the proportions in the mix of chemicals are also similar to those found on Earth. Because of the vast distance of the planetary systems and how signals from active stars can overpower those from the planets, the scientists decided to focus on white dwarfs, or sun-like stars that have died. As a white dwarf cools, material from its former planets, asteroids, and comets are pulled in and sometimes forms a disk around the dead star. The incoming planetary material changes the white dwarf's spectroscopic signal, which allows for measurement of the former planet's chemical makeup. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, an environmental project to save the forests in Cox's Bazar gets underway. In a letter to the world's billion-plus Catholics, Pope Francis has condemned clerical sexual abuse and its cover-up. The Pope said the Church must recognize and condemn the abuse with sorrow and shame. Much of the abuse was directed at minors. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Rome.
Never before has Pope Francis written to all Catholics, or as he put it, the people of God, on the crime of clerical sexual abuse. His letter was issued in seven languages. In his letter, the Pope mentioned the publication last week of a detailed Pennsylvania grand jury report on sexual abuse by the clergy involving more than 1,000 victims in the U.S. state over a period of 70 years. Papal spokesman Greg Burke commented on the Pope's letter.
It's significant that the Pope calls abuse a crime, not only a sin, and that he asks for forgiveness, but he acknowledges that no effort to repair the damage done will ever be sufficient for victims and survivors.
Francis said, looking ahead to the future, no effort must be spared to create a culture able to prevent such situations from happening, but also to prevent the possibility of their being covered up and perpetuated. He also wrote, no effort to beg pardon and to seek to repair the harm done will ever be sufficient. The pontiff also acknowledged that as a church community, we did not act in a timely manner, realizing the magnitude and the gravity of the damage done to so many lives. We showed no care for the little ones. We abandoned them. The Pope begged for forgiveness, adding it is essential for the Church to be able to acknowledge and condemn with sorrow and shame the atrocities perpetrated by consecrated persons, clerics, and all those entrusted with the mission of watching over and caring for those most vulnerable. The letter did not mention any new measures that would be adopted. The international research group bishopsaccountability.org Monday launched a database containing the names of more than 70 Irish clergy convicted or credibly accused of sexually abusing children. Several other countries are facing similar scandals, including Argentina, Australia, and Chile. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Pakistan's new prime minister, cricketer-turned-politician Imran Khan, vowed economic reform to fight corruption and implement austerity in his first public remark since being sworn in Saturday. In a televised address Sunday, he lamented Pakistan's debt burden approaching $100 billion, saying the interest on the debt is so high, more debt is required just to meet obligations. He said no country can prosper by living on loans from others. He also appealed to all Pakistanis to pay their taxes. Besting the two main parties, the Pakistan People's Party and the Pakistan Muslim League Nawaz, in last month's election, the 65-year-old Khan promised to introduce an Islamic welfare system, cut poverty, fight abuse and malnutrition, improve education, and seek better relations with Pakistan's neighbors. RAND Corporation South Asia expert and author Jonah Blank tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, the economy is priority number one.
And Pakistan will almost certainly have to go to the IMF for a loan. This has happened many times in the past, and each time the IMF has imposed an austerity program that Pakistan has had difficulty implementing. So that will be the immediate challenge, particularly when the United States government has said that it will not favor an IMF plan that simply allows Pakistan to take what it considers to be extortionate loans from China to build what is called CPEC, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor.
What do you make of this Islamic welfare system that he's suggesting?
He hasn't really given any details about that. He's been very vague on what this really would mean, and he hasn't put into play the trade-offs that would have to happen, because Pakistan's people really need a huge range of spending for their social welfare that no previous government has been willing or able to provide. Imran Khan has quite rightly pointed out the very low social economic indicators in medical terms, in family support terms, in educational terms. He has quite rightly pointed to stunting as a national hazard. He has identified a lot of the right problems, but so have his predecessors. And none of them have succeeded in summoning up the money and the political will to address them.
Aside from the faltering economy, militant extremism, water shortages, and a rapidly growing population, he's got a full plate.
He does, and every leader of Pakistan does. The challenges that Imran is going to have to face that are a little bit unusual are that he is the first elected leader of Pakistan to come to office without much of an institutional framework. His party, PTI, is a very new party. Until this election, he was really the only member of the party who was a known figure. For most of its history, he was the only one who even had a seat in parliament. And it doesn't have the long-standing, decades-long support that its two main rivals, the PMLN and the PPP, have. In fact, Imran Khan has had to go to members of these two other parties, particularly PPP, for support. He has not gotten support from either of these parties at an institutional level, but if you look at the members of his cabinet, over half of them served in the cabinet of the military dictator, Pervez Musharraf. Five others served in a previous PPP administration, including his foreign minister.
Jonah Blank of the RAND Corporation. UN agencies and the Bangladesh government have begun distributing liquid petroleum gas stoves in Cox's Bazar to help prevent deforestation, which has been accelerating with the high influx of Rohingya refugees during the past year. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Cox's Bazar is home to large areas of protected forest and an important wildlife habitat. The arrival of more than 700,000 Rohingya refugees fleeing violence and persecution in Myanmar has put enormous pressure on these precious resources. UN Migration Agency spokesman Paul Dillon tells VOA the refugees have been cutting down the trees and clearing land to build makeshift shelters. He says they and many local villagers also rely almost exclusively on firewood to cook their meals.
Consequently, the forests in that area are being denuded at the rate of roughly 4 football fields every single day. We're told by the experts at this rate, by 2019, there will be no further forests in that area.
Scientists note deforestation has devastating consequences for the environment, leading to soil erosion, fewer crops, increased flooding, and most significantly, the loss of habitat for millions of species. Dylan says disappearing forests are putting great pressure on the animals in the region.
It interrupts migration pathways and regrettably forces these sort of artificial confrontations between animals in the wild and communities as they move into areas that have been logged out, oftentimes in search of arable farmland and that type of thing.
The project aims to distribute liquid petroleum gas stoves and gas cylinders to around 250,000 families over the coming months. UN agencies say the stoves will have additional benefits besides helping to prevent deforestation. For example, they note smoke from firewood burned in homes and shelters without proper ventilation causes many health problems, especially among women and children who spend much of their time indoors. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. Along the Gulf Coast in the southern part of the United States, two distinct cultures have settled in the area. Vietnamese refugees and Cajuns descended from French colonialists who first lived in the eastern part of Canada and eventually resettled in Louisiana. Cajun cuisine is known for its unique blend of spices and seafood, sausage, and rice. Many of the Vietnamese who live along the Gulf Coast not only embraced Cajun food, but created something new, a fusion of two cuisines. VOA's Elizabeth Lee has details from a Vietnamese Cajun restaurant in Houston.
This is how we start to sort out the crawfish.
From the preparation to how it's cooked and seasoned, there is an art to making boiled crawfish. It's perhaps the best known Cajun food. But in Trong Nguyen's kitchen, there is a twist.
We sprinkle that with the Cajun seasoning right now.
Nguyen's restaurant, Crawfish and Noodles, combines Cajun cooking with what he knows of his own Vietnamese culture.
Back in Vietnam, my grandmom, it was a very great cook. So I was have that taste many years growing up with her. So I kind of had that taste in me while I work along, help her along to prep the dish.
Nguyen arrived in the U.S. in the late 1980s as a Vietnamese refugee seeking political asylum. He studied and worked several jobs, including one in marketing in a Louisiana casino, before going into the restaurant business. He is not the only Vietnamese immigrant on the Gulf Coast who turned to the seafood industry.
The first immigrant came to the U.S. is pretty much the people who live in a shrimp boat. You know, they do a lot of shrimp and stuff.
Embracing Cajun food, prevalent along the Gulf Coast, was a natural next step.
They do a lot of crawfish. They do a lot of shrimp, a lot of catfish, alligator, you know, on the Cajun style. So from there, the Vietnamese seem to understand that culture more. So Vietnamese dive into that kind of business. My version is I use a lot of Vietnamese seasoning. Mix it in some of the Cajun pot to make it because Vietnamese like seasoning.
The French culture is something else the Cajuns and Vietnamese have in common. Vietnam was a French colony, and the Cajuns' ancestors were French colonists.
I use a lot of French ingredient on my food.
Chef Nguyen calls the flavors in his dishes Viet Cajun, and the Vietnamese as well as non-Vietnamese customers at this restaurant have developed quite a taste for this fusion of flavors.
Mike Vandenbold and his friends eat here once a week.
I was born and raised in South Louisiana, so I know Cajun crawfish. And so when we came here, the extra Viet Cajun spice is what made it for us. And we like these better than the traditional Cajun crawfish.
It's very flavorful. There's lots of seasoning on it. And the crawfish is cooked perfectly.
The main thing is good food needs to be shared.
Nguyen says he would like the next generation of chefs to create an even better version of Vietnamese Cajun cuisine to celebrate the blending of these two cultures. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Houston.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo will hold an election in December, hopefully leading to a peaceful democratic transfer of power for the first time in the country's history. Sitting President Joseph Kabila came to power in 2001, having succeeded his father, Laurent Désiré Kabila, after his assassination. Joseph Kabila was elected president in 2006 for a 5-year term, and re-elected in 2011. Though his second term ended in 2016, and the DRC Constitution prevents him from seeking a third term, elections were not held, and Kabila remained in power. Following protests in September 2016, Kabila's ruling party and the opposition signed an agreement known as the Saint-Sylvestre Agreement on December 31, 2016. The agreement paved the way for elections, prohibited Kabila from running for re-election or changing the constitution, and committed the DRC government to a number of confidence-building measures intended to create the political space necessary for credible elections. In November 2017, DRC's National Independent Electoral Commission finally announced for December 23, 2018. Many feared President Kabila would nevertheless attempt to run for an illegal third term, but those fears were allayed on August 8th, the deadline for registering presidential candidates, when the DRC government spokesman announced that Kabila would not seek re-election. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, the ruling coalition's announcement of a consensus candidate, other than President Kabila, represents a significant step forward for Congolese democracy, said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert in a written statement. We are encouraged by this sign that Kabila intends to uphold his commitments to the Congolese constitution and the terms of the December 2016 Saint-Sylvestre Agreement by not seeking a third term. Government, opposition, and civil society leaders, along with the heads of the security services, share with President Kabila the responsibility of ensuring full respect for democratic norms. The Congolese people must be free to express their views and choose from the candidates without fear of violence, threats, or intimidation. We call on DRC's National Independent Electoral Commission and Congolese authorities to take the necessary steps to guarantee credible elections on December 23, 2018, said Heather Nauert.